Welcome to The Great Humbling. I'm Dugald Hine, co-founder of the Dog Mountain Project and A School Called Home. In the spring of 2020, I began recording these conversations with the poet and recovering sustainability consultant, Ed Gillespie. We call them The Great Humbling because this feels like a time of being humbled, brought down to earth and, if we're lucky, back into connection with land and soil and with each other. Thank you for listening.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of series 5 of The Great Humbling. I am, as always, joined by the wonderful Dugald Hine. Dugald, you're looking a little different today. For the benefit of the listeners, the last time I saw a post from you online, you were wearing that aforementioned coyote skin, I believe, and looking a little, just a little bit like the QAnon shaman. And I don't mean that in a rude way, but you were definitely summoning some stories to the hearth, weren't you?
That wasn't quite the image I was going for. I mean, a few people have pointed out that it looked a little bit Game of Thrones. There was a good excuse for it. We had Caroline Ross and Teresa Emmerich Camper here the other week, and they identified this coat that we had thought of for years, generations in Anna's family. It had been known as the wolf. Teresa took one look at it and went, "That's not wolf, that's coyote." So we'd had we'd had coyote hiding in our wardrobe disguised as a Swedish wolf, because that's the kind of thing coyote does. So that was my excuse for getting dressed up and looking all Winterfell on
on did look the part. You did look the part. You know, it's incidentally Jacob Chansley, the aforementioned QAnon shaman, is now actually running for Congress. So I hope you haven't got any plans to do similar things in Sweden.
Oh, Lordy. Wow.
It's also a special day for you today.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you for the reminder. It is my birthday. I was woken up in Swedish tradition by my family coming in bearing a cake with lit candles and singing the Swedish birthday song to me in bed this morning. And among my early half-awake thoughts, I thought, oh, I'm halfway from 22 to 70. And Anna said, 22, that's an odd age. And I said, well, it was the age that I was when I graduated from university. So in some sense, it's sort of like the beginning of adult life. I don't know. And then I actually remembered that I celebrated my 22nd birthday. I had a joint party with my old friend, Andrea Coleman, who is sadly no longer around. So that was a reminder of, you can do the sums and go, I'm halfway from 22 to 70, but none of us knows how long we're going to be here for. So it's just to be grateful, never stop being grateful, never start taking any of it for granted. So that's where I'm at this morning on my birthday, and what better thing to spend the day doing than recording with you, Ed.
Oh, well, thank you. I thought you were just trying to make me do some mathematics early in the morning. So I just wanted to start today perhaps with a couple of little reflections from the listeners. We've had a couple of nice comments come in from our audience. One is from Anna Boggis, who said, I've been listening to your series quite avidly. She said, apart from series number one, as going back to COVID felt weird, which is probably a mood we can all share. And she said, I came to your podcast via Ed's appearance on The Great Simplification, which made me laugh because that means that she's got you and I confused, which I think in itself is quite humbling. I find this on my other podcast as well, is like most of the listeners can't tell Mark and I apart. So you think about your ego and your contributions to the content and you realize that people are confusing you for the other guy anyway. So she'd been listening to The Great Simplification for about a year after her daughter had recommended it to me. But she was very pleased to hear your comments, Dougald, about the Richard Smith review, which made her feel more included as a doctor. And hopefully she's trying to find some more people in her prosaic daily life with whom she can discuss these ideas. Because the reactions she's finding at the moment is that she gets either blankness or that she's a doom monger.
Right. Yeah, I can relate to that in the sense that I feel like a lot of the work that we're doing, whether it's with this podcast or, you know, what I experience in the conversations with the people that Anna and I meet in the online series with the school, is just this sense of giving people a space where it's okay to be alive and not actually filled with doom and foreboding, but, you know, in one way and another, trying to face, you know, what we know and what we have good grounds to fear about, the trouble we're in, and then what's worth doing in the light of that. So, yeah, good to have you listening, Anna.
Yeah, and the other one was from Richard Brophy, who said, I was thinking about you and Dugald in the context of a little vignette that the journalist Paul Mason shared in his Conflict and Democracy newsletter recently. And it was a conversation between the poet Stephen Spender and George Orwell in June 1940, when the British were reeling from the crisis at Dunkirk. And Spender asks, don't you feel that at any time during the past 10 years, you've been able to foretell events better than, say, the cabinet? He's asking of Orwell. And Orwell says, well, where I feel that people like us understand the situation better than the so-called experts is not in any power to foretell specific events, but in the power to grasp what kind of world we are living in. And Richard is very kind in saying, you know, that's what he's aiming for. He doesn't have any answers, and I think nor do we pretend to have answers, but to look for an understanding of what kind of world we are living in.
Yes, I like that very much. And it does also occur to me that compared to in the era of Spender and Orwell and Churchill and so on, a better grasp of reality than the British cabinet might be a somewhat lower bar these days, but I think we'll let that pass without further comment.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I mean, I actually went and read the Paul Mason piece that Richard refers to as well, because, you know, what Paul Mason's talking about is his own sort of wrong-footedness in the context of what's happening in the Middle East. And the fact that, you know, the so-called promise of a multipolar world that would be more tolerance and more sort of, you know, gentle abrasion up against the edges between the multipoles is actually turning into something very different, which is actually a sort of chaos and void that is occurring, into which all sorts of horrors seem to be emerging. And I want to come back to this, I think, in a subsequent episode when I'll talk rather incongruously about the KLF.
Well, I look forward to what you've got to bring about the KLF, Ed. But yeah, I mean, I guess definitely part of what I want to spend some time around in this episode is just this question of, you know, what to say, what to add in the face of so much horror that is, you know, rightly occupying so much of our collective attention at this moment. But I think before we go there, what else has been going on with you, Ed? What's happening in your world?
Well, I'm watching the floodwaters subsiding from the sort of back-to-back storms that hit the country. And there was a lot of, obviously, inundation of the floodplains around here. So I've been watching those waters gently going down. And the Locks Inn has now reopened, which is obviously a focus for a lot of our sort of cultural activities locally. And I, in that sense, I also went to the Time and Tide Museum in Great Yarmouth, which is, it's actually a wonderful little local museum which celebrates the heritage of the herring industry. You know, when Great Yarmouth was the fourth richest town in Britain, off the back of that sort of North Sea bounty. And in the bookshop there, I picked up this lovely book called The A to Z of Curious Norfolk, which is one of those wonderful sort of local books that you only find in those type of contexts, by a woman called Sarah E. Doig. And I read this and I just had some, you know, some wonderful epiphanies and revelations, not least the fact that the Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti way of singing a musical scale was invented in Norwich. Did you know that?
I did not know that, Ed.
No, I asked Brian Eno the same question. I said, Brian, did you know where the Do-Re-Mi-Fa-Sol-La-T system was invented? And he went, no, I haven't got the foggiest. I said, it's in Norfolk. We can claim it. But yeah, a woman called Sarah Glover, who developed what she called the Norwich Solfar system. So every time you watch The Sound of Music and you hear Julie Andrews going for it, spare a thought for Sarah Glover, who first developed that here in 18th century East Anglia. But then there was another bit at the end of the book, actually. They say it was an A to Z, and the Z was for Zeppelin. And it turns out that the first ever bombs dropped on British soil came from a Zeppelin and were dropped in Sheringham on the North Norfolk coast on the 18th of January 1915, just at the start of the First World War. But apparently one failed to explode and a local resident picked it up and put it in a bucket, which is perhaps not the recommended approach.
It's not the best advert for Norfolk's common sense, is it, Ed?
No, exactly. normal for Norfolk.
I've been to that museum in Great Yarmouth, and it's a lovely museum.
Oh, I didn't realise you'd been there. Lovely.
But yeah, you know, that little story about the Zeppelin and the bomb, and you know, all far enough into the past that it can be an item of curiosity in a book rather than an instance of very present fear and horror and all the other things that it could represent. I mean, when I sat down with my notebook on Monday morning this week to think about what was worth talking about, it struck me that we got through the first episode in this series, without mentioning what's going on in Israel and Gaza. And I think that's reflective, actually, of something, which is a desire that I feel, and maybe you do as well, to not rush into adding more words onto the pile. But nonetheless, that was kind of sitting with me, and then I was taken back by Andrew, who writes a great Substack called Bogged Down and Aster. It took me back to something that Caroline Ross had written last week, a piece called Writing a Chalice. And here's what Andrew says. He says, I have been in a quiet lately. I think a fair few of us have. Into that quiet came a recent post by Caroline Ross about words in wartime. Wartime, most often referred to these last centuries as now, is, she suggests, a time for words. Not words, though, that unmoon the sky. She prescribes instead chalice. And here's a poem from Caroline's post. Writers write, singers sing, runners run, bakers bake. We write, and there's nothing wrong with our path, even in times of war. All times have been times of war. We may be a man in a cottage growing a forest from scratch, or a woman walking away from the devastation of her burning home. So we must grow our words from scratch, too. Words are not the curse. And they can tear down palaces as easily as build them. Just be rid of opinion. That's the only thing needing to be escaped. Then use words freely, generously, as though you were passing the simple birchwood cup you carved among friends, full of something good, sharp, yet honeyed. Because I assure you, we all really long for mead. And there's something there about looking for, listening for the way to use words that isn't just adding to the spray of opinions, that begins to speak to the part of me that has been inner quiet, as Andrew says, these last weeks. And then there were these words from Andrew's own poem, Genus Aerodramus, which starts with two quotes, one of which tells about the cave swift that makes nests out of its own spit, and the other one, which quotes from Hojin Aziz, speaking about Rojava. And this image from Andrew's poem really landed with me. A watcher's brow, one grotto arcs us, moon to sun. Her silence bows us, ear to drum, all word returning one to one, walking barefoot, bright upon the vow-swept floor. And then there was this comment which Andrew made in response to a reader about the whole experience of writing and putting words out there on Substack. And this resonated very much with me this week. At first, he says, it was tempting to believe that something more useful or potent in the work could be found by more likes, more readers, more subscriptions. But really, a few handfuls of close readers for a work and its insertion in a small circle of others writing around the same ideas, whether they see you back or not, is enough to generate that writer's full spectrum, I think. Even better if ideas start really cross-pollinating. That is where imagination's release range goes exponential. And I love that because I have that sense too of being held in or coming home to a weave with some of the other writers, friends and strangers who I've been meeting in these quieter corners of the internet over this past year while I've been writing on Substack. And whenever I find my attention getting drawn away into worrying about or caring about, you know, how big an audience anything I write might have, what I need is to be drawn back into that company passing the cup of words around the table with folks like Andrew and Caro and so many of the others whose words feed into our conversations here, Ed.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I also relate to that idea of being inner quiet. And when you're using Andrew's lines there, it makes me think and takes me back to the dark forest analogy of Yancey Strickler that I think you brought into the podcast in a previous series, whereby, you know, the internet started out as a space for creative experimentation and was quite liberating. But then in his dark forest analogy, there is also the risk and the threat that becomes quite suffocating. And I think that's where certainly some of my quietness comes from, because of the risk of being accused or cancelled or saying the wrong thing or not being able to articulate the thing I want to express in a way which is safe. And I actually had the pleasure of meeting Yancey the other week. And he's been doing some very interesting work. He came up with this idea around Bentoism, which was sort of beyond near-term orientation in the acronym, which was very much trying to get people to think about both the now and the beyond the individual into the collective and into the future, to try and think about how we might think of future me's and future us's, which did sound a bit Bill and Ted to my slightly untrained ear. But it also made me think about the collective poetry writing exercise that I've been using with groups that came from the School of Myth, you know, where you use the same provocation of sharing two or three poems and everyone responds to those together. And that's really not about big audiences. That's very much about the intimacy of the small group responding together to a particular literary provocation or piece of beauty. And Yancey actually, in the session I was in, introduced his new project, which is called Meta Label, which he describes as the creative economy in multiplayer mode, which I think totally plays back to this point that you shared from Andrew, which is like, how do we have a way of collaborating and supporting and pooling resources and skills and audiences in support of larger creative visions? So it's a way of people coming together to, and, you know, this would be a very much a Dark Mountain or even indeed a sort of Great Humbling or a School Called Home type of larger vision, which would allow people to group, collaborate, coordinate, you know, bring things together in a larger way in order to create a bigger mass and momentum. And I think it's potentially very powerful.
Thanks for that, Ed. I've been hearing rumours about Meta Label, so I'm going to have to go and check it out, because it does feel like another way of talking about one of the aspects of, I think, what we're getting at the school when we talk about regrowing a living culture and finding ways to, you know, to carve out some space within your life for the work that is yours to do, and doing that in the company of, you know, those whose work you get and who get what you're doing, and just how important that is, and how that's always been part of the way that any kind of a creative inhabitation of the world has looked. And another piece that struck me this week was from Adam Wilson of the Peasantry School, who's a constant source of inspiration for me and feels like another part of this weave of words and ways of being that I've fallen into through the school and through Substack and other connections. And he shared something, and this was behind a paywall, so I hope he doesn't mind me quoting a few lines from it. It's from a draft introduction to the book that he's been working on. And he called it a warning to readers. This story can't be told in prose. Poets place words in varying degrees of proximity to one another and invite the reader to make meaning from the spaces between them. A writer of prose fills those blank spaces with words in an attempt to render meaning more explicit. My friend Jean in Writers Group told me once that I often beat around the bush. I just want you to show me the darn bush, she finally said with some exasperation. Often, I simply can't show you the thing I'm trying to describe because I haven't seen it myself, except in fleeting moments out of the corner of my eye.
It reminds me of what Debussy said about music. So music is the space between the notes. And so maybe poetry is what's happening in this space between the words, which is maybe what Adam is alluding to there as well. It also makes me think of the Tao, you know, the ineffable, and the Tao that could be named is not the Tao. And if you're looking at it out of the corner of your eye, it is a sort of case of now you see it, now you don't.
I overheard a bit of conversation between my friend, the artist and theologian Vanessa Chamberlain, and Martin Shaw, where Vanessa was asking Martin about, well, you know, like, okay, well, what is Jesus like for you? How do you see Jesus? And he is like, I see him out of the corner of my eye, like on the edge of my field of vision. And Vanessa said, yeah, that rings true. There were a couple of other bits from Adam's post that struck home to me, where he says, you know, we're invited to generate opinions about how to live while others shoulder the consequences of our opinions. And to me, that's part of where the quietness comes from. And that goes right back to, actually, it's funny you should talk about Paul Mason, because Paul and I crossed paths for a little while back around 2011. If you read his book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, you'll find it starts with a conversation that he and I and a few others had around a table in a pub opposite the British Museum, like in the middle of the student protests in London in early 2011, in the early weeks of the Arab Spring. And I remember not long after that, I was alone in a studio in Brussels watching my Twitter feeds on TweetDeck, you know, that dates it, like all of these hashtags kind of streaming through the feeds that were all about what was going on in Egypt and Libya and Syria and so on. And this was long before we knew how dark many of those events would turn out to be in hindsight. But I remember just sitting there feeling no desire to throw myself into the ease with which we all seemed to be throwing out these hashtags. Mm. And just having this glimmering of, you know, maybe in hindsight, this will look a bit like those images that seemed incomprehensible to us in history lessons when I was a teenager, of the crowds on the station platforms in 1914, cheering and waving the young men off to war with their, you know, the promise that it would all be over by Christmas. That stayed with me, I think, over time.
Mm.
Then there's another side to it as well, which is also kind of captured in something that Adam said in that post. And he writes, "We see ourselves as powerless, even as we wield unprecedented power. Privilege seems to beget a felt sense of victimhood, which in turn breeds a nearly insatiable hunger for more privilege." And there's something in those words, too, that I want to stay with and allow them to unsettle anything too easy in my own responses or in the words that I might start putting out into the world. And I'm just, you know, having read that bit that Adam was sharing last week, I'm really looking forward to his book that he's working on. It's going to be worth the wait, because there is something very special in his voice and in his words.
Hmm. I think that's true. And, you know, sticking with perhaps, you know, the sort of poetic perspective on a lot of this, contrary to scurrilous rumours, I mercifully didn't kill off Tom Hirons, the sometimes of a wild god fame poet, when he was staying with me through toxic squash syndrome the other week. But Tom actually posted something as well this week, which caught my eye, which I think adds to what you've just shared from Andrew, because he said, you know, there's a quick reminder that we all live in the varying shades of a dystopian nightmare set in paradise. And Tom says, you know, if you're not living at the edge of some kind of breaking point, that's nice, but most people are actually at that point or beyond. And he goes on to say that one script of the nightmare tells us that we should aim for comfort, that success looks like, what nightmare? Life is great. I love this bubble. You know, to sort of insulate or atomize ourselves in the individualistic way that Yancey Strickler was also alluding to, by saying, you know, the kind of the now me and the future me, and that very individualistic style. But what Tom sort of remedies is he says, can I suggest that we aim instead for communion with the understructure of paradise, of that sort of holding foundation with each other, and with the life force that pushes between the cracks in the dystopian pavement. And, you know, he just implores us to love one another. Be relentless in your resistance to atomization, because there's gold everywhere. So hold fast with love. And I just thought that was a wonderful articulation of the response to what can feel like the overwhelming dystopia, but actually the gold bubbling up through the cracks everywhere is the communion that we need.
Yeah, those words rang true with me when I read them. And it's striking, among the kind of the sheer noise of language in a moment like this, every now and then you hear something that does ring true. And I think, you know, the thread that I'm sort of following or pulling on in this episode is how often it's the poetic that carries that true resonance for me.
Mm.
And you know, there's probably more to be said about why that is. But I think the starting point of it is just gently, quietly, firmly refusing, you know, the pressure to perform opinions instantly and constantly, so as to quieten down enough to listen for the bit that might be yours to say. the bit that you might actually have to give, to bring to the table in whichever kind of quiet corner you get to bring things. I found myself a few weeks back writing about this passage from David Cayley's Conversations with Ivan Illich, where Illich tells this rather shocking story about, you know, being asked by a student, presumably sometime in the early 80s in Germany, and, you know, but Mr. Illich, don't you care about the children starving in Africa? And Illich says, no, I will do everything to banish the feeling of care so that I can truly recognize the horror of what I'm looking at. Because care shouldn't be, you know, a warm feeling or a feeling of virtuousness. Care should mean something more costly than that. Care is love in action. And if I mistake, you know, my kind of published feelings, the press releases we're all invited to issue on whatever the most important thing on today's agenda is on Facebook or Twitter or whatever we're calling it this week, if we mistake that for care, what Illich is saying is we will miss the moment where we are actually in a place to act in the way that is what care means, what it should mean. And so I've been sharing that in recent weeks. And I'm aware too, in sharing it, that those words need to be passed on carefully, because there's this double-sided thing, or this kind of distinction that's been sitting with me a lot, that was kind of brought home to me earlier this year from the theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, you know, is often known for his role in the resistance to the Nazis and for being, you know, one of the lonely voices within the church in Germany in the 1930s that was really, you know, speaking out against the Nazis through the journey of those times. And he talked about the difference between cheap grace and costly grace. And he said, you know, the German church has been offering people cheap grace, but actually grace is costly. If you're not changed, if it doesn't make you do things differently, if it doesn't make you take another path with your life, then has anything really happened? You know, and the cost in his case includes that he was murdered by the Nazis before the end of the war. But I find myself more and more called back to that, to those lines and to that distinction. Even if I take, you know, what Illich is saying there about care, I think he's really making a version of that same distinction from his own sources. And he's, you know, he's asking us to hold to cleave to a costly understanding of care rather than a cheap understanding of it. But that falls on me too. If I'm passing on those words, am I really doing it in a way that carries the cost of what is being asked, or am I cheapening it and making it into an excuse for, like, feeling okay? I sit with those things and wait, and every now and then I hear words that feel worth passing on. And I suppose the other set of words that came to me this week, it was Andrew Curry in his Substack, Just Two Things, which brings an extraordinary mixture of material onto my horizon. But he was writing about Dylan Thomas, and he quoted this poem, which maybe we could put alongside Illich's strange and discomforting answer to the young man asking him about, don't you care? And this is a poem that Dylan Thomas wrote, you know, in the Second World War, called A Refusal to Mourn the Death by Fire of a Child in London. Never until the mankind making, bird, beast, and flower fathering, and all humbling darkness tells with silence the last light breaking, and the still hour is come of the sea tumbling in harness, and I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead and the synagogue of the ear of corn, shall I let pray the shadow of a sound, or sow my salt seed in the least valley of sackcloth to mourn the majesty and burning of the child's death? I shall not murder the mankind of her going with a grave truth, nor blaspheme down the stations of the breath with any further elegy of innocence and youth. Deep with the first dead lies London's daughter, robed in the long friends, the grains beyond age, the dark veins of her mother, secret by the unmourning water of the riding Thames. After the first death, there is no other. And that's it's just an extraordinary poem, an extraordinary act of language, an act of mourning in the refusal to mourn somehow.
Mm. It's phenomenally evocative. I'm assuming in some ways that one of the reasons that Andrew Curry has shared that is it's the 70th or just been the 70th anniversary of Dylan's death. Quite a remarkable piece of writing. You know, he used to live in Herne Hill in South London briefly, where around our old haunts. Apparently the title for Under Milkwood was borrowed from Milkwood Road in Herne Hill, which I never knew, which I sort of stumbled upon. And I ended up writing something. I did a sort of rewrite of the opening lines from Under Milkwood, but I set them in Brixton and called it Beyond Cold Harbour. And I remember our mutual friend Martin Shaw, who's obviously a big Dylan Thomas fan. I sent it to Martin. I said, "What do you think?" And he goes, "It's like a rusty hinge between two eras. You know, you can sort of hear the evocation," because I tried to replicate, you know, the incredible rhythm of Dylan's writing. And I knew that Under Milkwood was one of Martin's favourites, because when I was on the first Mundus Imaginalis course back in the day, probably in 2018, with him, it was Martin's birthday, and one of his gang played the Dubwood All-Stars Under Dubwood version of Under Milkwood, which is basically the opening lines set to dub reggae. And Martin quietly listened to this with the whole group and sort of nodded at the end and then smiled and said, "Never play that to me again."
Oh, damn. Yes.
I think he felt it was a absolute murdering of the poetry. But, I mean, I offer that as a sort of moment of brief levity, because obviously we are getting into some deep and dark roots here. But I think, you know, the other response to that quietening that is this theme, and, you know, the supposed perception around refusal to care publicly, I think the other post I saw that really resonated with me was one from Liz Slade on Remembrance Day, where she was talking about the Middle East, and she said, "You know, I've never been to the region. I'm not Jewish or Israeli. I'm not Palestinian, Arab or Muslim. You know, I don't have expertise in politics, terrorism, war, peace negotiations, trauma medicine, you know, international aid. And my voice is not one that can influence those who hold responsibility for what plays out." As soon as I read those words, I was like, I put my hand up metaphorically going, "Yes, I completely concur. That's exactly how I feel." She then goes on to quote the poem Making Peace by Denise Levertov, and the words, "Peace, like a poem, is not there ahead of itself, can't be imagined before it is made, can't be known except in the words of its making." And oof, you know, talk about a sigh of not relief but recognition when I read those words, because Liz says, you know, "Peacemaking is not biting my tongue or gritting my teeth or passively accepting the unacceptable for the sake of avoiding conflict. It is actually a creative act to listen for the loving course of action and be bold enough to follow it to the peace that lies on the far side of discomfort." And her challenge, if you like, was for all of us to practice peacemaking as an action, you know, in the immediacy of our own lives and relationships as an act of solidarity with the peacemaking that must happen at a larger scale. And I thought that was really profound.
I think we've probably talked about this before, but there's something that Gordon White passed on from one of his teachers, you know, an elder in the Andes, who said to him, you know, you don't pray for rain, you pray rain. You have to come into resonance with the thing itself. And Gordon said, you know, the same thing applies to peace. You don't pray for peace, you pray peace. And yeah, you know, the language to which I find myself drawn, most of which is quiet, most of which is like on my own or in conversations with friends or in small, gentle spaces, in moments like this, is a language of prayer. And it's a language of poetry. And I went back to an essay that John Berger wrote from 1982 called The Hour of Poetry to remind myself of what he said there, because I felt like it might have some clues just to making sense of why that is, why those are the responses that feel somehow resonant to me just now. And Berger says, you know, throughout a lot of the 19th and the 20th century, it made sense, it seemed to make sense to respond to the events going on in the world, to the horrors in the world, with a language of prose, with a language of reason that seemed to draw straight lines onwards into possibilities for, you know, making things right, making things better. And already at the beginning of the 1980s, and this is part of why Berger's such an important thinker to me, because I think that, you know, he was out there ahead of a lot of us, coming from within, you know, within a Marxist tradition, as an ally of so many causes of the oppressed around the world throughout his lifetime, seeing and saying that that kind of prose, rational, linear promise of progress that genuinely, you know, was and appeared open when he was a young man, that in some important way that was lost. And he says, because it's lost, now we turn to poetry. Now, poetry is the language that allows us to not close ourselves off, not harden ourselves, not insulate ourselves in that bubble that Tom Hirons is warning us against. And this is a bit from that essay, The Hour of Poetry. Every authentic poem contributes to the labour of poetry. And the task of this unceasing labour is to bring together what life has separated or violence has torn apart. Physical pain can usually be lessened or stopped by action. All other human pain, however, is caused by one form or another of separation. And here the act of assuagement is less direct. Poetry can repair no loss, but it defies the space which separates, and it does this by its continual labour of reassembling what has been scattered.
Perhaps it's no accident, is it, that this has been our most poetic episode in terms of the reliance on that poetic form. And I think in order to add to that, I'm now going to share a poem that I actually shared when I was with the Forward Institute recently on one of our responsible leadership residentials, because it was addressing some of the points that John Berger is describing there, because this residential was being held at Sandhurst, you know, the Royal Military Academy, which it's obviously a place with an incredibly complicated and potentially very controversial history, with all its colonial military campaigns. And we were in the Indian Army Memorial Room, which is a very grand room with stained glass windows, with basically these echoes of very turbulent and violent colonial histories and misadventures. And it had been sort of unspoken, you know, about how complex this relationship with the history of the place was. It hadn't been evoked and I wanted to bring a war poet into the room. And I chose this poem by Siegfried Sassoon, Everyone Sang, because we were holding this responsible leadership residential in the context of, you know, the omni shambles and poly crises that we feel like we're stumbling and bumbling our way through in an ongoing basis. And it's a beautiful poem. Everyone suddenly burst out singing, and I was filled with such delight as prison birds must find in freedom, winging wildly across the white orchards and dark green fields, on and out of sight. Everyone's voice was suddenly lifted, and beauty came like the setting sun. My heart was shaken with tears, and horror drifted away. Oh, but everyone was a bird, and the song was wordless. The singing will never be done. And I shared that poem because there is a misconception that it's about armistice, that it's actually about, you know, the end of the war. But Sassoon actually wrote it in 1919. And it was even misinterpreted by some of his war poet, you know, peers. Robert Graves, like, rather pointedly responded, "Everyone does not include me. You know, I'm not singing." But actually, what Sassoon was writing about was moments of relief in the trenches during the war. That during that misery and death and uncertainty, there was a potential for the transcendence of song at any moment. And that was the beautiful thing. And it really brought to mind also the singing in Manchester of Don't Look Back in Anger after the Manchester Arena bombings in 2017, this sort of spontaneous song that is actually about almost a forgiveness and an ability to move forward and not, like, resort to blaming and accusation and the perpetuation of further violence. And this brought me to this moment of reflection, actually, which is quite weird. You know, we're both the podcasts I do, the pleasures of doing this with you and the fifth series of The Great Humbling and the fifth series of The Future Noughts, which I think we started them both at similar times in those first crazy weeks of spring 2020, and from quite different pitched out positions, I would say, you know, not expecting the kind of the territories that we would explore to become increasingly aligned. And I was recording the most recent episode of The Future Noughts with the author Saatchi Lloyd last week. And we were talking about how do we talk to young people about the crisis? How do we engage young people? Because she's written two best-selling teen fiction books, you know, The Carbon Diaries, 2015 and 2017, which she wrote in the late noughties. But obviously, you know, we've long since gone beyond the near future dystopias and possible realities that she was describing. And I had this moment when I realized that actually there was an extraordinary alignment now between these two podcasts that had set out from different encampments and, if you like, had come together. Because what Saatchi said that really stuck with me, she goes, one of the most crucial things that we've touched on repeatedly, I think, in, you know, Get on Your Knees and this notion of communion and deep nature connection, was Saatchi referred to her own children as how imperative it was for her that they had as much as possible that fundamental connection with nature, that love and that conviviality and that sense of togetherness and oneness with the wider wild world. Because she said that will be the source of their resilience for life, because that will be the deep well that they are hopefully able to go back to time and time again to replenish and to slake their thirst and to give them the sustenance that they need during the difficult times. And if I was to circle back then on that question that Richard Brophy past us, you know, wanting to make sense of the world we're living in. Perhaps the congruence of these two podcasts has been inevitable.
Thanks, Ed. And thank you for bringing in that story about the Sassoon poem. I mean, I used to sing a setting of that in the choir that I sang in as a teenager. So it's a words that I know very well. But that reminder that it's not about the moment when the war is over. It's about these strange epiphanies, these strange eruptions of wonder that can happen in the worst of it all. I wrote something the other week about, you know, the world being woven through with horror and how we're reminded of that every time we switch on our phones, but the world also being woven through with wonder and needing to be reminded of that too, because if we only let an awareness of the horror in, then, you know, it breaks us. It leaves us paralyzed and unable to show up and play whatever part it might be that we have to play. And, you know, I'm addressing that to the people who read the things that I say. And we're all, by and large, extremely sheltered from the horrors that are going on in the world right now. It's like Vanessa Machado de Oliveira says early in Hospicing Modernity. She says, you know, this book is written for people who are in low or no intensity struggles. If I was writing for people in high intensity struggles, I wouldn't be writing a book. Like, I have other kinds of conversations. Other kinds of spaces where I'm encountering that part of the experience of what it's like being in the world just now. But I sent something by someone who'd read that little bit that I'd written. And it was Betty Moser, who I know because she came on a course with me and Charlotte Ducan a few years ago at Schumacher College. And she sent me a photo essay called From Grief to Awe. Because the valley where her father built a house in Greece had been utterly devastated by one of these extraordinary storms that has happened in Europe this autumn. And she'd gone out there to deal with the aftermath. And, you know, two people living in the valley had been swept away by the water and died. And most of the house that her father built was gone. And she sent me this with these photos and just a few words accompanying them. And what was extraordinary about it was that the whole thing was a testimony to both the horror and the wonder. You know, and she said actually going there and being involved in the aftermath was healing for her after the trauma of being somewhere else and hearing the news about what was happening. And you know, there's a new lagoon. The whole landscape has been reshaped by the debris. You see a photograph of this narrow little waterway as it used to be, and then this vast seeming riverbed that's left behind by the force of the water. And upstream, there are, you know, extraordinary rock formations that have been revealed that humans have never seen before because the landscape has been stripped back by the force of the water. And she said, you know, the locals have this saying in Greek, and she translated it, and she said, you know, they say, nature will help bit by bit to make it beautiful again. And in one way or another, that's part of the truth. And that's part of the truth that we get to participate in, because nature is not this other thing that we're completely outside of and on the other side from, which is back to what Saatchi was saying to you. So that was helpful to me, and I forwarded those pictures and words on to the Dark Mountain gang, and I think they'll be being published on the Dark Mountain site at some point in the coming weeks. So again, we're just passing these things around in the weave of friendships and collaborations and resonances, as one of the small things that we can be involved in.
Which is probably a suitable point to bring today's discursive digressions to a conclusion. But it would be beautiful if we can now play out, actually, with a song which I think chimes with a lot of what we've discussed. And I know we've used the Bertolt Brecht quote in a previous episode, you know, will there be singing in the dark times? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. And this track from Tamsin Elliott, which is called When the Times Darken, which is inspired by that quote. And if you haven't come across Tamsin's work, then I thoroughly recommend you check out her new album with the Moroccan musician Tariq El Azari, So Far We Have Come, which is a totally elegiac and quite stunning collaboration in the spirit of creative collaboration to larger visions of bringing North African and Northern European folk music traditions together.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We're grateful for all the messages we get from listeners and the other ways you support us, sharing these episodes, spreading the word, and rating them on iTunes and elsewhere. To explore further along the paths we walk in these conversations, subscribe to my Substack, Writing Home, and check out the online series at a school called Home. You can also find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling. And Ed is at FruCool on the platform formerly known as Twitter. The Great Humbling is produced by David Benjamin Blower, and the title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions.